The theme for the afternoon talk is a meeting with the real. A small incident happened at home two or three days ago, and it brought a smile to my face. So I thought I'd start off the talk this afternoon about it. It's got nothing much to do with the talk, but I found it amusing. My mother, who is 93, can you hear okay? Yeah. My mother, who is 93, 15 years ago, when she was 78, decided to emigrate to Australia to get away from me. And my sister lived there because she was married to a guy for years who worked for an airline, Qantas. So she had one son and one daughter and thought, no, the daughter's a better option. And she went there. So the incident is that just before I left, I had to swear on the Bible, because she's a Catholic, you know the kind, and that I would post from the Holy Land at least three postcards for. So I promised absolutely faithfully. Oded, who is here on the staff, I even sent him an email, please remind me there. So she didn't know when I was coming back. So she telephoned home, where my dear beloved house sitters are, serial house sitters they are, these guys, and my mother telephoned, but she rang the wrong telephone number. This is the proof of the small world we live in. And she rang the wrong telephone number. So when the guy answered the phone, she said, is Christopher there? And no, there's nobody named Christopher living here. She said, but I just rang, and this is the number there. And then he said, Christopher, I know Christopher. And he said, I don't know his telephone number, but he lives, I think, in the same street or nearby. And he walked around and knocked on the front door, and David answered the front door. And he said, Christopher's mum's phone, but she got the wrong number. He got my number. It's a small world, isn't it? She was ringing to remind me about the cards. Where are they? So, if I leave Tel Aviv early next week without them, shoot me. All right, back to the meeting with the real. Sometimes in the dynamic of events that go on in our life, we are very much under the influences of the external circumstances, and it concerns me, and I hope you do as well. And when we're under the influence of the external circumstances, we find ourselves as human beings with this rather intense need or longing or wanting to feel approved of, to get the approval of others. And there are an enormous number of pressures from day to day, from a variety of authorities and hierarchies, which tell us to fit in, to conform, to connect with under the circumstances of approval, the approval from others. And when the culture for that is so strong for us, it leads to this odd phenomena where everybody's effort in trying to retain some individuality, that people all end up the same. And we're trying to find who we are, but when we submit so easily to the external voices of authority which are around us, we end up as a a product. We end up as a consumer. We end up as being a rather faithful servant, if not slave, to all that we are told in terms of being successful. And it brings a tragic uniformity. And that uniformity and conformity generates more and more self-interest. And something is lost with us when we're just fitting in, being polite, submitting to hierarchies, and conforming to all the expectations which are upon ourselves. And that means that when we are products or when we are customers, as the pressure goes upon us, actually we lose something of being creative. We lose passion. We lose the sense of something spiritual. And our mindset and the thoughts that we have find ourselves very vulnerable to wishing to please, to make ourselves as human beings very agreeable to everybody else. When that happens, something authentic gets lost. There is a real cost for this. And it takes a lot of reflection and meditation and work on ourselves and asking of ourselves, what is original about me? What's special? Not in an egotistical way. What is creative? What shows that as a human being I am able to stand on my own two feet and say no? And that empowerment is perhaps one of the first steps, we might say, to contact with the real. And to take from time to time with the talk with you some smaller examples. In the dreadful isolations that go on, and in the separations that go on, and the apartness from the others, we start losing something about what a real and the encounter or the meeting with the real is. And what we find ourselves is we live in the spell of images. And these images are so strong with us that they easily touch us and, as I mentioned the other day, feed into something missing. And thus the movement of the inner life finds itself going towards others to get accepted. And when that need is very, very strong towards other or others for acceptance, for recognition, the pressure on others brings about their withdrawal. The more I want from you, the more pressure as a human being I put on you, the receiver of it says, I can't take this pressure. And she or he steps back. So the stronger the neediness for attention from the other, the more the impact on the other, who more likely will start taking steps back. And then it's a kind of painful waltz. One's wanting, the other's resisting, and the dance goes on till it crashes. What a way to live. The other aspect, with this encounter with the real, and again it was touched upon with you a couple of days ago, that the past, and it isn't an easy one, the past has to become rather, as much as possible, rather quiet in consciousness. And for it to become rather quiet in consciousness, we must give rise and emphasis to something else. And that something else, in this case, would be the here and now. So if I give too much attention to the past, the images, the pictures and the stories will enter more and more into the present. I think I'm actually living with the real, but what I'm actually living with is memory. What I'm living with is the shadows of the past. What I'm living with is the old. It's entering into consciousness, and it's like a filter or a film covering the consciousness, which is actually inhibiting me from contact with the real. And to remember, every problematic state of mind, without exception, is a disassociation from the real. Every one of them. So wherever there is anything problematic in our life there, it cannot be problematic without some influence from the past. And since our past is our images and our ideas and our experiences and what we've held on to and what we've got stuck with there and which are not resolved for us, that easily enters as a filter, as I say, across the present, and that then becomes the means by which I look at myself as a human being and look at this world there, and if I have strong feelings about it, based on the past, which is gone, and I have strong feelings, those feelings will say, this is real. My suffering is real. My unhappiness is real. My depression is real. My confusion is real. My state of mind is real. My thoughts are real. Everything which has happened, which is unhealthy and unsatisfactory, is an emergence or a fruit, karma as the Buddhists would call it, from the old, landing on the present. It's got enough feeling in it to say, this is real. This is the real. The feeling makes the real. And so when we begin to change, and in some of the dialogues and in the small groups and the one-to-ones here, sometimes, as the tradition says, we've offered, shall we say, the opposite to the old. So one of the very, very common ones, and a number of you in the one-to-ones and the groups here, there, is the issues of the views about oneself. And the views about oneself, obviously the most common one is self-blame, self-criticism, the lack of self-worth. It's made more real by how much feeling is going with it. The more stronger the feeling, the more I believe this is who I am. This is the real. The feeling is the confirmation of it. So when we say, let's explore the polar opposite to it, there's no feeling in it. Because one's got so used to rubbishing one's existence and putting oneself down, one can't get a sense of what it would be to view in another way. And even, as some of you have reported, sometimes we experience some joy. I know it's a miracle on a retreat, but it does happen. And we experience some happiness and we feel good there, and we're glad we're here, and all that feeling is arising, and as some of you report, and incredibly quickly in comes a nightmare Buddhist view, it won't last. And it's not going to go on. As soon as I get out here, I just know I'm going to be back in my nightmare, etc. So even when happiness comes, the habit of the old conditioning and view sweeps it away, and then it uses Buddha's teachings to help reinforce the sense of low self-esteem. Oh, it's all impermanent, it won't last, it's just going to go, I know it. You know, as the Buddha said, he said it's the equivalent of picking up a snake by the tail. So, the communication, the exploration there is, if we're going to come out of the pattern of the habit of fault finding with oneself, criticizing oneself, not feeling good enough, so that habit and the self, it's very impersonal really, gets hooked together, then I need some exploration or some sense of something which is not that, because one has been doing it for long enough. And religion, I'm trying to be kind here, and secular culture, and even more kind, both communicate in a very powerful message, something is wrong with you from the beginning. So with one, we're all sinners. The Middle Eastern religions need to look at that one. We're all sinners. And therefore, we need something. We need the book. We need whoever. We need Jesus. We need prayer. We need God. We need something. And then we will no longer be sinners there. Eastern traditions are no better. Everybody's under the spell of their karma. We've done all these terrible things in the last life, and now we're having to pay the price for it. Another. And then there's a secular culture. Well, you start off, you're just a nobody, and you've got to work yourself to death, and literally to death. And if you really work yourself to death, then you're really somebody. See, because you're a nobody otherwise. They're. And we know our parents sometimes have inherited this nightmare story. And so the religion and the secular culture, dare I say, a plague on both houses with regard to this. It already makes us feel not good enough. They both got the same message, we're not good enough. And therefore we've got to do something to be good enough there. And the shadows of such influences of these institutions and others as well keeps impacting. So it seems no matter what I do and how much I do and how successful I am, there is still, it's still haunting me. It's still coming in some way or other. So therefore our meditations and our reflections to find a way to get back a little bit and to get a little bit more, dare I say, original sense, as the Buddhist tradition sometimes says, original mind, original consciousness. Get back to the beginning, get earlier or get deeper, in which we're not, and we're refusing, not just, it's not the polite not of the English, you know, we are refusing to buy this story, I am not good enough. It's a story. It's a conspiracy. It's mutual influences there. And if we can find the moment and the moment where that kind of thinking of not being good enough is out of the window, perhaps, I'm talking here just for a moment, I'm not being ambitious for the rest of your life, just for the moment. Yeah. Perhaps it may give me some opportunity to recognize and acknowledge what is already valuable as a human being. And it always was valuable. It always was valuable. Even from birth it was valuable. And that willingness to bring in the value of the human being and her or his or our experience and to give it full acknowledgement, to recognize it. And sometimes, as you know with a few of you here, I said, please, get the pen and paper. Go to your room or out on the lawn. Have the sense just being in the moment and to actually detail bullet points. I don't like the word bullet, but bullet points there. Of those a few things or a large number of things which you actually recognize shows your value as a human being. You actually put it down there on paper and look there. And let that reflection for others with this exploration or encounter to find the real. There are the various loving kindness meditations. Have we had any in this? Yeah. No. Tonight. So tonight there will be a loving kindness meditation by the embodiment of loving kindness that Leela's giving tonight. Thank you, Leela. Teasing my sweetheart. And in the traditions there, as I said earlier, sometimes we can draw upon what I got in mind. In looking at religion for a moment, I was really touched the other evening when Iran was given the talk, and you were talking. No, Sandy, one of you, anyway, God, it's lifetimes ago, was giving this lovely talk on feelings and emotions and the rising from the ashes. So sitting there, and Sandy is sitting next to me there, and Abelila, I've been here a lot of days, by the way. That's my excuse. And so Sandy was there, and listening, and then at the very, 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 very end of it, you read a prayer with some lines. So I was sitting there just watching, had my eyes open, and people around, the women here, were sitting and smiling. And then the prayer was read, and suddenly there's bucket loads of tears pouring out there and sobbing going on, people wiping their eyes. What did you tell them? And I just use it sometimes as the small example that in a precious and lovely and deep talk, and sometimes a prayer, a few lines which are genuinely sacred, there's something so receptive inside of us, it touches some really beautiful place inside, and the feelings that move up through the body, and then the feelings convert into the water element. How miraculous is that? Start of feelings, and now the water's pouring out there, you know, feelings are dropping out of your eyeballs. It's a much better miracle than walking on water. So I use it as a small example here, where if we have the tendency to, in a way, of not being with the real there, but these influences from the old and the habits and the conditionings, then it may be genuinely worthwhile to explore, as an example, one of the forms of the loving kindness meditations there, and you, instead of relying on the church or the churches or whatever, to actually, you write your own prayer, a prayer to yourself. And in that prayer, once again, of what one appreciates, or perhaps what one wishes to explore and develop, what you know is precious and beautiful as a human being there, and then from May I, etc., allow that development and exploration, and so that each word in the prayer, and it takes some care, really has some meaning for you, but it's vital, and as Leela will point out this evening there, it's vital as well that prayer, as the Buddha said, must, or the deepest wishes of the human beings, or expressions of the sacred elements of words from a human being, must go in all directions. In other words, if you begin the prayer with some precious lines, may I, live with love, may I dissolve negative perceptions of myself, may I live in harmony, may I be flexible, May I express generosity. If you just do that and forget the rest, I mean, after a week or two, it's going to be complete narcissism. It's all me, I'm all right, etc. You know what I mean? So, loving kindness meditations must generate in all the directions, words of the Buddha here. So, yes, one is part of humanity, part of the expression of life, so that one remembers as well the same kind of lines or some fresh lines which in the same prayer, may this be for the welfare of others. May others be happy. May others be peaceful. May others cease to be judgmental. May others stop putting themselves down. May others live happily. May others care for each other or whatever. So that it safeguards the imprisonment from in the self of just me there. And it genuinely generates it out. And those kind of prayers give a sense of something true and authentic. We are getting, so to speak, close to the real. I've got water first. Very much.
I might be all right. We'll see.
So I have some poems, and in the dynamics, just a little few words before the poem here. In the dynamics of our encounter, if in certain situations in our life, which really have an impact, a very strong impact upon us. And I have in mind here the joyful ones and the really difficult ones, whatever they might be. And it really has a strong impact upon us. Quite often, the wish is to move on, if it's painful, of course, as quickly as possible, to move away from, and if it's really joyful and happy, the wish to make it last as long as possible. So the pleasant we want to keep, the painful we want to be away from as possible, far as possible. The exploration of the Dharma is not just to label everything as impermanent. I get concerned when there's too much emphasis on this impermanence. But more importantly than that is that when there is some experience which is taking place, which is strong and significant for us, and it really has the impact on consciousness. It affects us and we feel the effect, some heart, mind and body sometime. It's a real signal out of the nature of things that something really requires our attention and is not to be ignored. And that giving of the attention to the joyful and the painful, the power of the attention is to look and reveal and show as much as possible. And when something changes and brings out some insight out of us, in Dharma language, that moment of insight, something is clear. In that moment of insight, that is the meeting with the real. It's the moment of insight which emerges out of a situation which there is clarity about and there is a genuine benefit with regard to. In that moment in the Dharma, that clear seeing is the moment of the encounter with the real. And those encounters with the real have as its purpose to free us up. Then we know we're meeting the real, because it's freeing us up. Why? Because human beings are free. That's why. So I have some poems here. Thanks for the light. This one's called A Wild and Uncertain Life. Our shadows can only offer us a bizarre security. But I have no wish to give shape to my wild and uncertain life. I won't dishonor the wilderness with a life plan. The great breath moves me along at its will. While the only sacrifice occurred before I took birth. Knowing that decisions clung to or rejected trample on the wild flowers in the forest. I only wish to learn to love without assurances, so that I can enjoy the terrible rumble of the ocean. I only wish to learn to love without assurances, so that I can enjoy the terrible rumble of the ocean. The encounter with the real, the meeting of the real, is rather lost through the excess of too much self-interest. So when the self is so preoccupied with itself, particularly the harsh voice of criticism, and we're so preoccupied with the self, that is the shadow. The self is the shadow of the human being, and showing itself, as I said earlier, in the negative, in the fault finding, in the criticism. And though we might track back and we might say, this event was the cause. This situation in my past, in my teenage years, last year or years before or in childhood, I may say this is the cause or list the causes. But the human being isn't assured or guaranteed a liberation through the naming of the causes. So there may be some benefit. It may help to understand the process of what is taking place. And I may say, and it might be true, what I am or how I am is the effect of what has gone before. And therefore I track back and I see the causes and conditions which produce this as the effect. But tracking back will not liberate. It will name, it will describe, it will confirm, it will make things relatively clear, but it can't liberate simply because you and I are not an effect. That is not who we are. And if I believe this is who I am just an effect of my past, then that is an imprisonment into a world view of I am nothing but cause and effect. Ooh, ooh. What a view for a human being to have to carry around. So the exploration here is the recognition of paying acknowledgement, and as has been said, of course, there is genuine value in looking to the past. But the arising of the relationship to everything, the relationship which you and I have, matters more significantly than what we relate to. It's the relationship to it. What kind of relationship do I have? If, in the looking into oneself, the relationship is changing, the meeting with the reality will also change. But, here comes the but, it is often said, especially in our kind of circles. I really want to know myself. I remember being on the road for 3 years, this is late 1960s, so the thought and the view was, well, having now made the outer journey, traveled around, whatever it was, number of countries, and lived that rather sweet way of life, now is the time, as others will say, to make the inner journey. So the voice inside of us says, I really want to know myself. I want to know about myself. I want to know who am I. I want to touch those places. I'm willing to touch the beautiful and the ugly places inside of myself. I really want to know myself better. It's a noble, nearly noble, exploration. In some respect, we could say there is no end to what we can know about ourselves. We can never stop finding out about ourselves because we are constantly engaged in some kind of encounter or meeting with the real. So the knowing myself is knowing my relationship, so-called, to the real. There. And this relationship to that changes according to how I feel, the mood, the thought, the state of mind. And I say it is so fascinating to getting to know oneself that it can become a kind of lifelong activity. You know, endless retreats. Oh, dear, oh, dear. And therapies and workshops and counseling and the vast reservoir and supermarket of what's available. Tons of it. All on the theme of getting to know oneself. There is a value in it. My concern would be, though it can get, knowing oneself can get closer to what is real or what is true and authentic there, but it's not the core purpose of Dharma teaching. The core purpose of Dharma teaching is not about getting to know oneself, The purpose of Dharma teaching is liberation. It's much better. Honestly, trust me. So, though I may look into all the dynamics of what's going on with me as a human being, and I give real attention, and I get some genuine benefit insights from, and these meetings really can provide a lot of genuinely good insights and change our life, and many of you know this, but it would be a pity to think of knowing myself, going deeper in meditation, being more skillful in communication, having a more emotional, well-adjusted being, shall we say, and say, even though some will say, oh, I'll settle for that, Christopher. No, don't settle for it. There. It's valuable and important, but the great meeting or encounter with the real is to know what an authentic, real liberation is, what it is. And that will mean that to know the real, self-interest has to go. It has to go out of the window. Somewhere it has to get forgotten. And the liberation is not personal. It's not a personal liberation. It's not a liberation which says, okay, I've had the meeting with what's authentic, what's real, and now I am liberated. Oh, dear, it's pathetic, isn't it? It even sounds terrible. I am liberated, and I know what liberation is, and I'm coming here all the way to Eindhoven to tell you what it is. Oh, dear, please go home. So, the I, so, you can send me back. The I, so the I easily comes in, and with its desperate need to land somewhere, it wants to land on jackpot. And jackpot is liberation. Or in, do you understand jackpot? Jackpot? Anybody? You win the lottery if you jackpot. You. Yeah. All right. So the eye is desperately keen to land on jackpot. So when one was in the mundane mind, jackpot was becoming a millionaire. I know it's a pathetic thought, but people do have it. And then one goes beyond that, and then the jackpot is nice house, nice home, agreeable partner, good kids and quiet neighbours, and a good job with an insurance policy. Jackpot. And then one looks at all that and says, no, surely not. Not with death tapping on my shoulder, surely not. And then one goes, okay, I've got to work on myself and look at myself and see who I am and look at my past and my present and the dynamics there and the constellations of my life and learn something about myself. And it is precious and beautiful. And in a way, it's a step further there. But in the recognizing of the different aspirations that a human being has, and valuable and important as they are, still, it's liberation. And that liberation, just to repeat a little bit, is not, I want to get liberated. The I has no bearing on that. It's to realize, that means to make real, what liberation is. And liberation, to understand liberation, it's a liberation which makes life is so free, so fundamentally free, it makes everything possible. If life was not free, if it was not authentically free, then none of this could happen. It is so free that it allows the good, the bad, and the ugly. It is that free. And we cannot know the encounter with the real as long as we don't know what freedom is. And why, and what is it we don't know what freedom is? Because we're not living with the real. We're living with the greed. We're living with the negativities. We're living with the blame and the fault finding and the projections and the putting down, which is the manufacturing of the self. We live with all of that. And somehow or other, we've got so used to it, we actually call that living with the real. That's real. And then our parents tell us, you're going on a retreat. You're not living in the real world. You know, our parents have become the authorities on what's real. I mean, that's a pathology. They should be knocking on the door of their nearest psychotherapist saying, help, help. I think I'm living in the real world. So the discovery of the real, the exploration of the real, is synonymous or goes together with insight, with love, with truth. But deepest and its most essential there, it's a liberation which recognizes that liberation is the liberation of the real, is to make it obvious there. And the real is so authentic. Unlike everything else, the real doesn't know birth and death. That's the real. It does not know birth and death. There is no birth and death in the real. It's not possible. And human beings have the extraordinary capacity to realize the real. Freedom does not know birth and death. It cannot. Doesn't make a scrap of difference whether human beings are here or not. The liberation stands and the real stands. And we can know it. And that's better than being a millionaire. Better than knocking on the door of your therapist, coming on a retreat. Well, it's a bit hard to say that, I have to say. Coming on a retreat there and working on oneself. Something else matters. and the encounter with the real, you'll know liberation is there. And in a beautiful way, liberation does liberate. That's why it's called liberation. It does liberate. It liberates from problematic life. It's not the real. It liberates from all those shadows of the old, because they're just impressions being carried on. They're not the real. And it allows the movement of love and friendship and kindness there easily. Not because one feels, oh, I should be a good person. It's nothing to do with being the good person. Liberation just lets kindness and love and friendship and warmth and clarity and conviction and standing on one's own two feet and authenticity, it lets that express itself. It gives it the real chance, because it isn't the weight of the old. And let's stay fully committed to it. Thank you.